Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We had really the absolute, the perfect setup for a big Bering Sea storm.
The changing climate conditions behind the weekend's historic storm. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, in many communities, local schools served as evacuation centers.
Trying to attend to student learning while we also attend to storm cleanup and assessment of damage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
A historic and powerful storm slammed into western Alaska this weekend, bringing major flooding and high winds to dozens of communities over almost 1,000 miles of coastline. State officials have reported no storm-related injuries or deaths, but say damage was extensive as wind tore off roofs, houses floated off their foundations, and boats were battered and sank. As waters start to recede, the state is taking stock of the wreckage. KYUK's Nina Kravinsky reports.
The National Guard is activating all guardsmen in the western region of the state and is deploying more to the area. The Alaska National Guard's Adjutant General Torrance Sachs said at a press conference Sunday the troops would help with debris removal and damage assessment. They'll be sending additional guardsmen to Hooper Bay, Nome, and Bethel.
It is critical to have boots on the ground.
Sachs said having troops in hub communities will allow them to deploy to smaller villages more quickly. The Red Cross is also sending out volunteers. The state has identified 5 communities that have been impacted the most by the storm. Those are Hooper Bay, Scammon Bay, Golovin, Newtok, and Nome. As of Sunday, 3 communities had a boil water advisory in effect. They were Elim, Unalakleet, and Hooper Bay. Also, multiple communities, including Hooper Bay, had lost power at their airports. Governor Mike Dunleavy said at the press conference that they're hoping the recovery response moves quickly, and efforts wrap up before freeze-up begins in about 3 weeks.
Wherever there is help that is needed, we'll be getting that help there as soon as possible.
He issued a disaster declaration on Saturday to free up state resources. The damage from this storm ranges about 1,000 miles, from the Kuskokwim Bay all the way up through the Bering Strait. Climate expert with University of Alaska Fairbanks, Rick Toman, said the distance of severe damage due to the storm is part of what made it unusual. So is the timing. It's the strongest September storm since records began over 70 years ago.
We had really the absolute perfect setup for a big Bering Sea storm.
He said Typhoon Murbach formed in a part of the North Pacific where typhoons don't usually form, since the water usually isn't warm enough. But the water there was the warmest it had been in the last century.
And after it developed and started moving north, then it moved over water that was as much as 7 degrees warmer than the long-term normal. That is a dramatic difference from normal for the open ocean. That is really amazing.
He says as climate change continues to cause seawater temperatures to warm, storms like this one could become more common in Alaska. A Hooper Bay resident who identified themselves as Ben called into KYUK on Sunday to describe the scene there, where hundreds were sheltering at the school due to severe damage and power outages.
Now, this is a wake-up call. We don't know the future, but we can't be ignorant or ignore it also. We need to face the facts and reality. These storms are getting worse and worse.
Also taking stock of the damage as the storm blows over is U.S. Representative Mary Peltola. The state's sole congressional representative is from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, home to some of the hardest-hit communities. Peltola has been in touch with Governor Dunleavy, as well as mayors of some of the hardest hit communities, and was briefed by FEMA yesterday afternoon. She's worried about the possibility of people's subsistence harvests being damaged amid the flooding and power outages, as well as damage to infrastructure and equipment.
Those are the kind of assessments that I'm going to be waiting patiently to, or not so patiently, actually, to start hearing back on.
She says she and Senators Murkowski and Sullivan will be working on securing federal disaster funding. In Bethel, I'm Nina Kravinsky.
In Golovin, residents are in cleanup mode as their community works to restore power, phone service, and clear debris. After the floodwaters receded, some locals are left with feet of sand inside their homes.
My place here, we've got 3 feet of sand. We're still shoveling out with a crew here, trying to go ahead and get the sand back out of the living area so you can get the sheetrock to go ahead and dry off.
State Senator Donnie Olson of Golovin says other residents in his hometown, located about 70 miles east of Nome, are dealing with the same issues. But some of his neighbors were not as lucky. Their homes were moved across town or floated away completely.
Housing still is the major issue down here because so many buildings have been shifted, if not knocked off their foundation. And you know, there are now debris, including houses, that are in the middle of the road blocking the way before we can get the roads back open.
Water levels rose 9 to 10 feet above the normal high tide line on Friday evening into Saturday morning. Then the power went out on Saturday. As of this afternoon, power was partially restored in the community, but not at the school. Olson says homes are the priority, so residents can save the subsistence food stored in their freezers.
Because when that was out, we had a number of people that had to evacuate because there was no heat in homes. And now that we've got power back on, we want to make sure that stays there. And then after that, we go ahead and make sure that some kind of a food security situation where we can have something to eat as well as something to drink.
Outside organizations have been sending relief. The World Central Kitchen delivered food, and Northern Air Cargo and Ryanair brought in bottled water. The state of Alaska has identified Golovin as one of the several communities impacted most by the historic storm. The Lower Kuskokwim School District is also assessing damage to its schools. Half a dozen of those buildings served as evacuation centers during the storm. KYUK's Will McCarthy has more.
Over the weekend, residents of six communities took refuge in the village school building. Classrooms turned into bedrooms, gyms into informal dining halls. Now, those same classrooms are filled with students again. Schools are already returning to instruction, even as staff begin to clean up and take stock of damages. Here's Kimberly Hankins, the superintendent of the Lower Kuskokwim School District.
So everyone is sort of back in session and, trying to attend to student learning while we also attend to storm cleanup and assessment of damage in and around, not just the main school building, but all of our facilities.
According to Hankins, schools served as evacuation centers in Newtok, Kipnuk, Nightmute, Quigilinuk, Queethluk, and Tununuk. At one point, as many as 70 people were sheltering in Newtok's school building. In all six communities, residents have since been able to return home. So far, damage to school buildings seems to be limited. Hankins said it's a point of pride that people can turn to the school in times of crisis.
You know, I'm just happy that we have the space to offer in order to shelter folks when situations like this happen. We work closely with the community so that folks receive the message that they are welcome to come up to the school and they can seek safety there.
Although no school interiors flooded, there was significant erosion in some communities that brought the buildings much closer to the shoreline. In Newtok, Hankins estimated that the school building is now only 90 feet from the water, down from about 125 before the storm. In Napakiak, the school is only 75 feet from the water. Some boards beneath the school and piping running to the building were also damaged in Napakiak. Teachers had to evacuate their housing, which sits closest to the river, as water rose to their doorstep. Long before the storm, both Napakiak and Newtok had plans in place to retreat from the water because of erosion concerns. Newtok is relocating the entire town to higher ground, whereas Napakiak is moving its community further back from the river. I asked Hankins if there will come a point that these schools might be deemed unsafe for use given the continued erosion.
So certainly student and staff safety is always our number one priority. So our team is constantly assessing and reassessing. You know, I'm really hopeful that we won't see additional fall storms that are as impactful as what we just experienced, but, you know, we never know.
For now, local maintenance staff will be working on cleaning up debris left from the storm. As a clearer picture of damage emerges, the school district may send extra staff out to communities that need more resources. In Bethel, I'm Will McCarthy.
The National Weather Service says the storm was near Point Hope by this afternoon. Meteorologist Jonathan Christ says the storm will continue to weaken, but tonight and into tomorrow, he expects wind to increase in the northwest Alaska region, including in Shishmaref and Kivalina.
We're expecting the water levels to continue to fall. However, those winds are going to keep the surf high, and so we're expecting coastal erosion to continue at Shishmaref and Kivalina.
Christ says while the storm is not over, the worst has passed.
Main impacts that the storm will have caused, especially in terms of flooding, are over at this point.
Flood warnings for the western Arctic coast expired late this afternoon. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's Republican Party could oust a local leader for supporting Lisa Murkowski.
The Alaska Republican Party can have divergent voices and divergent opinions, even at the district level.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Officials say Alaskans looking to support storm relief efforts should donate money to reputable organizations. Brian Fisher is the director of Alaska's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says, at least for now, monetary donations are what's needed the most.
At this time, we don't need stuff and things. We will work on that. And when we have specific requests, we will share that with the public to make sure we're all helping our neighbors. But at this point, the most important thing to do would be to support those organizations.
Those include the Red Cross of Alaska, the Salvation Army's Alaska Division, and the Alaska Community Foundation. Alaskans can donate to the Red Cross online and select your local chapter to make sure the donation stays in the state. The Alaska Community Foundation has also set up a Western Alaska Disaster Recovery Fund, with 100% of donations going directly to rebuilding efforts. The World Central Kitchen is also accepting funds. More information is available on our website, alaskapublic.org. The storm that slammed into western Alaska over the weekend was the result of several factors all converging to make it so destructive. That's according to Rick Toman, a climate scientist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who says, first, Tropical Storm Murbach formed farther to the east of Japan than one would expect, and it picked up energy from water that was much warmer than it used to be, based on historical records. Then, as Murbach became an ex-tropical storm, low pressure aloft picked it up and pushed it north into the Bering Sea. And Toman says the orientation of the jet stream, a high-altitude band of strong wind, was such that the storm's edge tracked right along hundreds of miles of Alaska's coastline, causing severe damage. Toman says as ocean temperatures continue to creep upward, similar huge devastating storms hitting Alaska could become more likely.
Without the very warm ocean water, you just don't get these tropical cyclones. Now, as it moved north over cooler water, it transitioned to the X portion of Murbach, or a typical mid-latitude storm structure. Now, that might sound like just a meteorological technicality, but in fact, it's incredibly important because typhoons, hurricanes, are actually fairly small features as far as storms go. They're compact. And when they transition to the mid-latitude structure, they expand greatly. They grow in size. And that was a key portion of the impacts. The center is passing west of St. Matthew Island, and we're getting this tremendous flooding hundreds of miles east on the Alaska coast.
Tell me more about that. What did we see as far as the wind speeds and the water levels?
Wind speeds in most places, well, to the extent we know, were not super high. The highest gust, for instance, in Nome, 59 miles an hour at the airport. In some places, we don't actually know what the highest gusts were because power went out at the airports. But certainly, many places had winds of the 55 to 65 miles an hour. Some exposed places had wind gusts up above 80 miles an hour. But more than the peak wind speeds, it was really the duration of very high winds, of gale force winds, 30 to 50 miles an hour, sustained winds for 18 to 30 hours, depending where you're at. And that's really what drove the water up, those strong, sustained winds pushing the water, acting as a plow, if you will, just moving that water, and where that moved into south or west facing coastlines, that water just piles in there and is pushes it up. So it was really the duration of the winds in most places rather than the absolute highest gusts.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting. So there were major impacts, obviously. We haven't heard about any deaths at this point, but certainly people lost their homes. And there was quite a bit of advance warning, really. I mean, you could see this coming from a long ways away. There were computer models. But does it seem like there was much of a response, I guess, before the storm?
Yes, this was very, very well forecast by the large-scale models. Was every detail correct? Of course not. But certainly the models were showing the threat of a major Bering Sea storm. By Monday afternoon, it was clear that something big was going to happen somewhere in the western Alaska coast. And by Tuesday, the models had converged on a track that was very close to what actually happened. But to the extent that that information got out there, a lot of information on social media, there's always ways to improve the communications. But I think the important thing that we need to keep in mind is in rural Alaska, we need to provide as much lead time as we can. We need to give people the heads up. And I think, you know, this is a stormy part of the world. Storms happen in western Alaska. They're going to happen again. And when something is really out of the ordinary, we need to make sure as many people know about that as long in advance and know this is not just another storm.
Yeah. Speaking of another storm, I guess just in the sort of short-term future, there was some speculation that there was another typhoon forming that may come towards us. What is that storm called, and is that actually going to hit Alaska, do you think?
So, super typhoon Nimmadal affecting southern Japan. At this point, though, that does look like that is going to dissipate long before it gets to Alaska. There is a slight chance that it could move along the Aleutians as a very weak storm, but definitely nothing like what we just saw.
Well, then I guess, you know, looking forward further into the future, you know, years into the future, can we expect these kind of storms to happen more as the climate continues to warm?
Well, to get a storm like this, as we talked about, you have to have all the pieces fall in place. And of course, most of the time they don't. However, I think this is a really important wake-up call for Alaska in the sense that Murbach formed in an area that we just simply don't ever expect tropical systems to form. It's historically the water is not warm enough, but the water is warm enough this year, and we are certain that in the coming years, coming decades, the oceans will continue to warm. And so although Murbach formed in an area where it's extremely rare, it's very likely going forward over years, decades, we will see more storms in that part of the Pacific. And that is much closer to Alaska than storms curving east of Japan.
That was Rick Tumman, a climate scientist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Alaska Public Media asked a spokesman for Governor Mike Dunleavy about criticism of state preparations before the storm hit, And while the spokesman did respond to an email, he did not answer the question in time for this broadcast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
Leadership within Alaska's Republican Party will decide whether to oust Kodiak's sitting district chairman at a hearing tomorrow over his public support of Senator Lisa Murkowski. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath reports.
In July 2021, Alaska's Republican Party formally endorsed Kelly Shabaka, Senator Lisa Murkowski's Trump-backed Republican challenger this November. The party censured Murkowski that same year. In February, Republicans from District 5, which encompasses all of Kodiak Island, passed a resolution supporting Murkowski.
We were concerned with the early endorsement, or unusually early endorsement, of another candidate in the Senate race.
Duncan Fields is the District 5 Republican Party's chairman. Fields says Murkowski has been a longtime advocate of local issues, like Alaska fisheries and the island's Coast Guard base. He voiced his support for Murkowski in a brief campaign video posted to the senator's Twitter account earlier this year.
I'm Duncan Fields. I'm a commercial fisherman from Kodiak, Alaska. I support Lisa Murkowski because of what she's done for Alaska over the arc of her career.
And some from the state GOP took notice. Two other district chairs, David Peck and Wayne Ogle from District 7 and 8 on the Kenai Peninsula, filed complaints with the state's party leadership. Each outlined Fields' quote, promotion of the candidacy of U.S. Senator Murkowski, end quote, and call for Fields to resign or be removed as district chairman. Whether or not Fields will receive any type of formal discipline or stay in his position as chairman will be decided at a meeting Tuesday evening. District Chairman Peck and party leadership could not be reached by phone Monday afternoon. When reached for comment, Ogle said he's fine with Fields supporting Murkowski, just not as district chair. Fields says the state party's rules don't prohibit local districts from endorsing a different Republican candidate, and he's careful to distinguish the district chairman who filed the complaint with the state's party leadership. But he says whatever happens Tuesday could set an important precedent going forward.
Whether or not it's their intent to sort of purge every person in every district that has an opinion different from the party, or if there's going to be a sense that the Alaska Republican Party can have divergent voices and divergent opinions, even at the district level.
Senator Lisa Murkowski received more than 50% of the vote in the state primary in Kodiak. Fields says Kodiak voters tend to lean towards more moderate candidates historically, and this isn't the first time local elected officials have been punished by the state GOP for working across the aisle.
I think as party chairman here in Kodiak, I feel this latest incident in that context is a further effort to silence the interests of Kodiak.
The Alaska Republican Party's hearing is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Demand for lumber is pushing the state's Division of Forestry to pitch the sale of old-growth forests near El Capitan Passage on northern Prince of Wales Island. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, a regional conservation group is arguing that the 340-acre sale could come at the expense of the island's deer, fish, and even tourism.
The state's Division of Forestry is proposing the sale, which would include clear-cutting 8 million board feet of old-growth forest. That's according to the preliminary best interest statement released late last month. And the division's Southeast Area Forester, Greg Staunton, says the timber industry has been struggling since the Biden administration paused old-growth logging in the Tongass. Timber industry jobs in the region fell to their lowest level on record last year, according to a recent report.
We have operators and purchasers that have a need for timber because they're not able to fulfill their needs other ways through, like, say, the federal government.
The proposed timber sale area is near the El Capitan Passage, close to the cave site and accessible through the island's main road system. It's about 7 miles west of the city of Whale Pass. But the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says the damage it could do outweighs the good.
You're essentially hammering an area that's been hammered already.
That was Meredith Traynor, the council's executive director. Traynor says the surrounding area has been heavily logged.
We're concerned that they're going to be logging additional old growth in this area that already has a matrix of impacts from these other entities, and that the sort of the characteristics of the sale don't really hold up to the light in terms of whether it's a reasonable thing to do at this time in that area that's already seen these impacts.
The council is also worried about potential impacts to the island's deer population. She says the council wants to discourage eating into areas that deer depend on.
And as I think anyone on Prince of Wales knows, deer habitat and the ability to harvest deer is incredibly important for community members there, and even for folks from Ketchikan who often travel to Prince of Wales to harvest deer.
And, she says, old-growth forests are important to maintaining stream quality for fish. Even though stream restoration work could help, Traynor argues that could be avoided altogether if the El Capitan sale doesn't go forward. Another problem that the council sees with the sale is its proximity to the Prince of Wales Scenic Byway. It would clear-cut growth along that road.
We have these beautiful places that they are so stunning and memorable and impactful for visitors and for residents alike that they're designated as a scenic byway. And then there's just this continued effort by the state and by other entities to clear-cut the land right along the byway.
The council suggests that a better alternative would be to log the area in smaller chunks, like 50 acres, instead of all at once. The Division of Forestry says it plans to leave a buffer of at least 100 feet between the clear cuts and nearby Twin Island Lake to protect scenic views. And the division says it plans to leave at least 300 feet between the clear cuts and salmon-bearing streams. The Division of Forestry's determination says about 20% of the proposed sale area is important seasonal habitat for deer. But the State Department of Fish and Game does not have major concerns about the impact on deer and their predators as a result of the sale, according to the document. Staunton, the regional forester, says there's a plan in place to manage the regrowth of the area after the logging.
And one of those ways of doing that would be through pre-commercial thinning in the future.
That's where timber crews go through a previously clear-cut site and rip out some of the regrowth in an effort to ensure the trees don't grow too close to one another. It's an effort to make sure future trees grow big enough to be commercially viable. The state says thinning would also increase the amount of food available for deer as more light reaches the forest floor. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Nina Kravinsky and Will McCarthy in Bethel, Davis Hovey in Nome, Chris Clint in Anchorage, Kristen Dobrath in Kodiak, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.